Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 8th, 1996. In the Fireside Room this evening, we are having a theme forum. This evening's forum is entitled, How Can We Make Peace? As Citizens and as Christians. Let's listen in.
And we'll honor people's time better if we get going and then end on time, and people will come as they come. So, Jeff in the Tate Ministry office, we're ready to go. My name is Chris Sharon. I'm an assistant for a program this summer, helping to coordinate the teaching staff especially. I help organize the forums, and in that capacity I'll be moderating tonight. So I'd like to introduce the forum a bit, and then after each of our three kind of yeast people who get our loaf of bread, our conversation going, after each of them have spoken about 5 minutes on the various things they're speaking on, then I'll ask you to each raise your hand as you're ready to either ask a question or share a story, so that I can make sure that one person speaks at a time. I invite anyone who disagrees with stuff that they've heard to share it. One of the difficulties we have with forums is making a space in which everyone feels like they can share their opinion, and I hope that we can create that space tonight so that we can learn from each other and struggle over genuinely difficult issues. So, in addition to that, I hope that we don't think that in any sense we'll resolve all the difficulties tonight either. This type of forum ends up asking questions and making progress on questions at best, and hopefully those conversations and questions will continue with us as we leave the room and continue in our time here at Holden and after we've gone. The week this week is a week that raised for us this question, how can we make for peace? And as a way to get us started in a broader scheme, I decided to just read a couple of paragraphs from the World Book Encyclopedia under Adam Baum. And then, as a way to ask the question, how do we respond to that, to read two brief verses, or a couple of verses, one from Jeremiah speaking to Jerusalem, and then Jesus speaking to Jerusalem. And hopefully those three readings heard reflectively can just be set a stage for us, both raising the question of what kind of society do we live in, what kinds of war-making things go on, and what are the hard questions in response that we're struggling with. So let me read those, and I invite you, if you want to close your eyes or want to just get comfortable and in a reflective space. The Manhattan Bomb Project. In 1939, many scientists succeeded in splitting atoms of uranium by bombarding them with neutrons. They found that split atoms released neutrons and energy. Many physicists recognized the military possibilities of atomic energy. They felt the United States government would be interested in further research in the chain reaction. So, in the summer of 1939, Albert Einstein wrote a letter to President Franklin D. Roosevelt explaining the problem. Early in the 1940s, the scientists received the first funds for research. The results of the research were hopeful, and in 1942, the United States government authorized a concerted attack on the atom to produce the atomic bomb. The Manhattan Engineer District of the Corps of Engineers, the Manhattan Project, was organized and accomplished this goal. The first experimental explosion of the atom bomb took place on July 16, 1945, in New Mexico. The first military application followed on August 6, when the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, Japan, by a high-flying B-29 bomber. More than 4.5 square miles of the city were destroyed. 3 days later, an atomic bomb of improved design exploded over Nagasaki. This weapon used plutonium rather than uranium, as the fissionable material. It destroyed about 1.5 square miles of the city area. More than 92,000 people were dead or missing in Hiroshima, and at least 40,000 in Nagasaki. Equal numbers were injured, but the war was ended quickly. A reading from the prophet Jeremiah, the 6th chapter. For from the least to the greatest of them, everyone is greedy for unjust gain. And from prophet to priest, everyone deals falsely. They have treated the wound of my people carelessly, saying, "Peace, peace," when there is no peace. They acted shamefully. They committed abomination. Yet they were not ashamed. They did not know how to blush. And finally, from St. Luke's Gospel, the 19th chapter. As Jesus came near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, "If you, even you, had only recognized on this day the things that make for peace. But now they are hidden from your eyes. Indeed, the day will come upon you when your enemies will set up ramparts around you and surround you and hem you in from every side. They will crush you to the ground, you and your children with you, and they will not leave within one stone upon another, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation from God." So, three, at least for me, challenging and provocative readings. And it's in that context of war and what response we make to war that we've called this forum tonight, and that we've asked these three panelists to get us started with stories and perspectives, each from their own work and lives. And so, as each of them speaks, going from your right to left, I just ask them to briefly introduce themselves, and then they'll each have about 5 minutes to share with us. And after that, then we'll invite the whole group into the conversation. So, Karen. Okay.
My name is Karen Blomquist, and I'm Director of Studies in the Division for Church and Society of the ELCA. I'm going to be continuing the setting of the context for the discussion, seeing that what I see as my role this evening is to draw your attention to two documents that have come out of the ELCA in the last couple of years that I think very much speak to this issue. And I'm going to just raise up a few brief portions that I think especially relate to the topic, how can we make for peace, the topic for this evening. I have a few copies that I brought along of both of these, so if you don't have a copy and really want one, you can take one of those. The first is not so much dealing with international peace, but because it relates so much to a number of the themes that have been discussed this week, especially violence in our communities. I wanted to at least mention the message on community violence that was adopted by the Church Council of the ELCA in a little over 2 years ago. It was interesting because we had already started work on a piece on international, on a project on international peace, and a lot of people were saying, yeah, but how can we even begin to talk about those until we begin to look at the upsurge of violence in our communities? And I think there have been sessions certainly that have been focusing on that. But there's some interesting parts of this, and I'm going to be reading from pages 3 and 4, just a few brief bulleted items. Talks about how we pursue our commitment to peace as a community of worship, as a community of education and service, as a community of advocacy, and as a community of ongoing deliberation about these issues. But I think the list under education and service provides some helpful concrete handles communities of faith are called to minister to those in captivity to violence through efforts such as providing a safe place, counseling, and other services that enable people to face and deal with the realities and fears of violence in their lives, mediating to achieve just and peaceful solutions to social conflicts in our communities, educating children and adults in how to deal with anger, disagreement, discrimination, and disappointment in nonviolent ways, assisting those affected by poverty, racism, and various forms of domestic violence and unemployment, organizing activities and programs that are effective in moving youth, especially those attracted to gangs and hate groups, from disillusionment to hope. Just a little caveat here. One of my colleagues, Gaylor Thomas, has been very, very instrumental in providing some leadership of how can churches relate to people who are in gangs. He and Jim Wallace of the Sojourner Community and others have really been very active in some gang summits and saying, hey, the churches need to think not just about those who are kids in our congregations, but how do we develop some helpful, effective relationships with youth on the streets, in gangs, etc. And that goes on with a number of other efforts that we can make within our communities and enabling people to reclaim their violence-plagued communities, especially through such things as community economic development. So I just want to raise that up as one item that I think is helpful for suggesting a lot of concrete steps in addressing community violence. The other thing, document, though, I want to raise up is the social statement that was adopted just a year ago at our churchwide assembly. When we began work on this, we said, hey, this is really a statement for a post-Cold War era, and therefore the kind of standoff between the U.S. and the Soviet Union was not the defining parameters of, but how do we look at some of these matters, especially in a day when regional conflicts are more and more the realities that we're confronting in our world. And there's a lot of theological stuff here, which I'm not going to get into this evening other than to say it certainly grounds our call to be peacemakers in our belief in a God of peace and the pervasive witness in Scripture. Now, that means coming to grips with some of the parts of Scripture where it doesn't always look like a God of peace. But I think there's been some solid biblical work here to help people really counter and say, you know, how do we understand God as the source of peace in not just our personal lives, but in international relations. And it talks here about the church being four kinds of presence. A disturbing presence when it refuses to be silent and when people shout peace, peace where there's no peace, quotes the passage that Chris just drew our attention to. And therefore, naming and resisting idols that lead to false security, injustice, and war, and calling for repentance, and especially the way in which we place our security in weapons or warfare, or ordain the inherent right of one people, race, or civilization to rule over others. Certainly the applicability of that matter in terms of a lot of regional conflicts. Secondly, it talks about the church as a reconciling presence, how the church creates bonds among different peoples, whether local or distant. And a few weeks ago, I had the privilege of, at one of the global mission events in South Dakota, hearing a person who very much embodies that, Bishop Harris, the Lutheran bishop in Liberia, who has been, you know, literally at the center of the warring factions there. Did some of the rest of you there? And just a powerful person because he, from what I've heard, more than just about anybody in the midst of the horrendous violence that's gone on in Liberia in recent months, has really been, you know, reconciliation is kind of the heart and center of all that he's about in the midst of that conflict. And I think a powerful kind of witness of the role that the church can have in the midst of that. Thirdly, the church as a serving presence, and by serving this means holding power accountable advocating justice, standing with those who are poor and vulnerable, providing sanctuary, meeting human need. And fourthly, a deliberating presence, really saying, now how do we sort through these difficult issues? And including, how do we confront human evil through nonviolence? That, finally, is one of the points, one of the features of this statement that I think is significant, especially for those of us as Lutheran Christians and a lot of others who have, to a large degree, relied on the, quote, just or just unjust war tradition for understanding when it is morally justifiable to enter into conflict. This statement, I think, to the impatience of some, still kind of operates out of that tradition. But it opens the window a bit and says there is another voice that we need to hear much more, and that is the voice of a much more pacifist kind of witness. And I think it reflects the fact that the group that worked on this included people of a pacifist persuasion, someone like a Dan Erlander and some others like that, but it also included a four-star general who was very committed to the issues of peace in here. And so it was not, you know, it was not just, you know, quote, the peaceniks working on the statement. And therefore, I think that was reflected in the fact that it passed by an overwhelming majority at last summer's churchwide assembly. I've used up my time, but let me just point to this booklet, a study booklet on the statement. These are actually for sale from our office. I think I have a few copies. I may leave them in the bookstore when I leave or something. But there's an interesting chart here on how it looks at the different ways that we look at, that we work for peace through politics of cooperation, by building a culture of peace, and by working for an economy with justice, and how the different actors are involved in that.
Thank you. Peter.
I'm Peter Thompson. I'm a member of the Community of St. Martin's in Minneapolis, and I do human rights work as an attorney. And I just want to mention a very specific initiative that a church is doing to witness against violence. And the church, it's a broad-based coalition of peaceful persons, but it largely is Roman Catholic. And to understand it, I have to give you a little factual background about El Salvador, and hopefully it'll tie in toward the end. But it's the witness that is being carried out is down in Columbus, Georgia, at Fort Benning, a U.S. Army base, and there's a school there that is sponsored by the United States Army. It's called the School of the Americas. And that school trains South and Central American military leaders who then go back to their own countries. And it's not well known. It's becoming better known, and Jack is writing a book about it, and we thought since we were both here this week, we could maybe work it into this peace forum. In the early 80s, there were three events in El Salvador which began to bring home a little bit to this country that war beyond just another guerrilla war or civil war in Central America. The first was there were four church women who were raped and murdered, one of whom was from Minneapolis, down in El Salvador, and the military and the government said that they had no involvement in it. The next event was an event that really wasn't heard about for the next 10 years. There was a village called El Mizote, and there was one woman in El Salvador who claimed that the Salvadoran military had come and murdered everyone in the village, all 900 people, almost all women and children. And the Salvadoran government claimed that it didn't happen, and she was crazy. And then Archbishop Oscar Romero was assassinated after he gave a homily telling the Salvadoran military to lay down their guns and to stop killing. And a few weeks later, he was assassinated. At that point, a young Marinal priest, Father Roy Bourgeois, was arrested down at Fort Benning because he was aware that Salvadoran soldiers were being trained on our soil in Georgia and then were going back, and he believed they were involved in these atrocities. And so he climbed up at night in a tree 200 feet high with a boombox, and he had Oscar Romero's last homily where he had requested that the killing stop, and he played it very loudly so all the Salvadorans could hear it in Spanish again and again and again until he was arrested and sent to prison for 18 months for doing it. Then in the late 80s, November 16, 1989, six Jesuits, their housekeeper and her daughter Selena, were murdered at the University of San Salvador by a group of Salvadoran soldiers. And in response to that, Father Bourgeois, now convinced and having done educational work over a number of years and now living in Minneapolis, and then I met him because he was continuing to get arrested doing civil disobedience and I was representing him, felt he had to move back to Fort Benning. He lives in an apartment right at the entrance to Fort Benning, and he's been a witness. He's either been in prison or there carrying out actions trying to bring to people's attention that this, that the training of people who are, he believed, doing acts such as this were on our soil. The war resolved itself, at least to some extent, in El Salvador, and part of that resolution, the UN appointed a truth commission, and part of the demand was there be an investigation into these various events, and the investigation was carried out, and the findings came out, and they found out that the majority of the people who had carried out the rapes and murders of the church women in 1980 had been trained at the School of the Americas, that the majority of the people who had been involved in the assassination of Oscar Romero had been graduates of the School of the Americas, that the majority of the soldiers who had executed the six Jesuits, the housekeeper and her daughter, were graduates of the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, and that the woman who said that the 900 people who were massacred in El Mazote was not crazy, that she was the only survivor. They went, they dug up the graves, they found the skeletons of the 900 people, and that the soldiers who committed that, the majority of them, were graduates of the School of the Americas. And so now each year, there are other graduates of the School of the Americas too. Harold Bonzer, who was the despotic dictator of Bolivia, Manuel Noriega, who was the president of Panama and is now serving time for drug running, Michel Francois, who's the chief of police in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and who helped the overthrow President Aristide, Robert de Busen, who started the death squads in El Salvador, and many others. And so each year now on November 16, to commemorate the murder of the Jesuits, there is an action down at Fort Benning, School of the Americas, and some people are trespassing, doing civil disobedience, arrested, and some people are calling attention to the fact that this is occurring on our soil with our tax dollars doing the training.
Well, I'll keep my comments very brief. I'll just say, make 3 points. One is...
Wait, introduce yourself first. A lot of people know you, but...
I'm sorry. Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, and also part of the community of St. Martin, which is a faith-based community, and Peter and I are part of that community in Minneapolis, and have been here teaching on some of the new Jesus studies, and now looking at the issue of families and what we would do differently as parents in a society who care about children. Just three quick comments to share, draw some ideas we might want to reflect about. One is the story that Peter just told raises a very troubling question in relation to U.S. foreign policy generally and the School of the Americas in particular. It raises the question, is that training and then the aftermath, these murders and coups and dictators, does that mean we're doing our job really well? Or does that mean we're doing our job really poorly? If we're doing our job really poorly, it implies that we're training these people and they're not getting it, right? And they go back and do what they want to do. If we're doing our job really well, it implies that that's what we've trained them to do. And unfortunately, I would report, based on my experience of living and working in Central America, and some of you, I saw that there's a few copies of a book that I wrote based on my experience of living in Central America called War Against the Poor, and the subtitle is Low Intensity Conflict in Christian Faith. And it looks at a strategy of warfare that the U.S. embarked upon, particularly in the 1980s, to try to essentially maintain governments and economic relationships that were highly unpopular, highly skewed in terms of helping the rich and hurting the poor. And as I think I document fairly thoroughly in that book, it included this U.S. warfare strategy called Low Intensity Conflict included a specific targeting of the progressive churches in Central Latin America. So one of the things I'll be doing in this book that I've been asked to write about the School of the Americas is really exploring this question, is this litany of ills and ill will that Peter has described. Does that mean we've done our job really poorly and therefore should shut the school down? Or does it mean that we've done our job really well and we've been training people to do this and therefore we need to shut it down? And we now have affidavits from soldiers who have been trained at the school of how they have been trained in actual use of torture techniques, various kinds of things that all came up in the trial. Peter's very modest, but he is an incredible lawyer and has a very long history. You could listen to his stories all night. So that's one frame of reference. The second one I struggle on is in terms of the issue of peace. I mentioned in, I think, my session yesterday that projections are, if we continue moving forward in the economic realm as we now are through agreements like North American Free Trade Agreements and General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade, that somewhere around the year 2050, half of the world's people will live in absolute poverty. And that for me is very much of a peace issue, because what I discover in my neighborhood and what we discover in Rwanda and every other place that we can look at where there's lots of social turmoil is that unless there's greater justice, we are going to be living in environments of violence. Again, I think this is very, very challenging to those of us who are U.S. citizens, because so much of the vision of where we're headed as a global community in terms of economics is taking shape because of what U.S. multinational companies and other international companies want. Mm-hmm. And I think we really have to challenge that vision as a challenge to peace. Third area that I would just touch on is in our own country now, and I've been talking this week about families and children in crisis, I think we have to look very carefully at the social priorities of the country. And I find it rather abominable that in the aftermath of the Cold War, with our most formidable enemy defeated and falling apart, that we continue to have astronomical military expenditures that, by the way, are going to be rising steadily now as a proportion in relative to our discretionary spending on social programs over the next 5 or 6 years. That Japan, I've talked a little bit about how the U.S. does so much poorer in terms of the social well-being of children than any other industrial country. And part of that is linked, I think, to the fact that federally funded research and development dollars in this country continue to be squandered in the military sector. About 70 to 80% of all federally funded research and development dollars go to that sector. In Japan, it's 5. In Germany, it's 15. So that's a whole another area that I feel like our neighborhoods are unraveled. We're, in a sense, dismantling the homes of the poor in order to build walls in protection of the very wealthy. And then I said three, but I want to add a fourth. And that is simply that I personally struggle so much with my faith in relation to these issues. And part of that struggle for me is a really exciting and healthy one, I think. But I am increasingly convinced by, I guess, the world that I live in, but also by the study that I'm doing, that we have downplayed to our own peril Jesus' understanding of a nonviolent God. And I think that's probably the most radical statement that we can make, or the most radical lesson that we can learn, and the most challenging in a world of violence and injustice, is how do we live in that context. But I would just point out for tonight's reflection that for three centuries, I think there were three profound images that lived on of Jesus. And two of these show up in the artwork of three centuries of art. And it wasn't the crucifixion didn't show up in art. It wasn't the resurrection theme that even showed up in art. What shows up in the art of the first three centuries is Jesus feeding and Jesus healing. The Jesus community eating daily bread, sharing that together, and healing. And the other legacy is that for three centuries, you were not a Christian and a soldier. The nonviolence of Jesus lived on until Constantine. So I don't know how to live with that exactly, but I'm pretty convinced, or I'm growing more and more convinced and trying to struggle with how to live that out, is what does it mean to be faithful to a nonviolent God, and a God who reflects that nonviolence through Jesus and vindicates that life in a resurrection. So I'll stop there.
Thank you to each of you for provocative comments to get us started in a serious discussion. Yes, please.
But listening to the three of you, I'd like to try and get some context in it, just from some of my understandings. And so one of them addressing some of the issues that you raised, which you covered explicitly, were my preference would be, and perhaps our limited time, to keep it more at the international level, because that's where most of our defense dollars are being spent. That's where a large share of our GDP goes. And so there's fears that we have out there, which directly reflect how do we build a community, having been here the last week, I've heard several references to the correct statement of the horror of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. We just, out of the encyclopedia, read some of the casualties that occurred there. Mm-hmm. If we're going to talk about any single city, we have to keep it in context. During the siege of Leningrad, well over, I think, a million civilians. So we're going to talk about a particular city, we have to keep it in that type of context. Now, it's a lot of significance is attached to the bomb, rightfully so, because it was a single incident, and it's an instrument that we continue to wield. In fact, I'd love to discuss the decision process that led up to that, and why perhaps we still have arsenals, and whether it was the right or wrong thing to do, because it still seems to be largely unresolved in our cases. And addressing some questions that you raised, when I listen to that, it almost sounds like the U.S. Army via Fort Benning, Georgia, is running amok on its own. When in fact, my impression is that for the most part, U.S. policy in Central America, we have a long tradition of, at least since the turn of the century, stomping around in Central America, typically with the Marine Corps. Nicaragua, we staged a false coup in Panama so that we could set up the canal. The Marines were in Nicaragua in the 30s and set up the Somoza government. They were in Haiti in the 20s, the Dominican Republic in the 50s. So there's a long history of the United States being down there. And this isn't to condone what you've just described, it's just, it's our lake, so to speak. And it'd be hard to believe that the U.S. Army on its own, out of a school at Fort Benning, Georgia, would be conducting that without guidance from the State Department. In fact, it's always been, for the most part, schools like that with very close cooperation with the State Department, meaning the higher level policy decisions that are being made. And so that's where perhaps more attention should be paid.
And the whole secret CIA, I mean, they are involved and behind a lot of this. You can even see things right on Channel 6 in Minneapolis, where it's a local station, and they're doing these things that are exposés in the CIA that are just incredible. And, you know, it just goes on and on. And I have read underground literature for probably 30, 35 years. And I mean, it's like, this kind of stuff isn't news to me. What blows me away is that so few people know that this is going on for so long. It's like our heads are in the sand. I do want to say one thing, because I want to bring this into this forum, and I hope it stays here. Population. I notice it doesn't get brought up in these classes and in the meetings. And if we keep growing, you know, like you said, by 2040, the size of the population, 2050, then that is poor will be the entire world's population that exists now. So that's as many people as are on this earth will, by your statistics, be poor, Jack. You know, we have to stop having babies. And if we don't, how are their children going to have children or their grandchildren?
Again, just make quick.
Let me add one more element to that. Thank you, Jack. I don't want to dominate this, but God, it is. I'm impassioned about this because it's neglected, because there's religious things about it. You know, it's like people, oh my God, well, you know, we're going to populate the earth. Well, I think we've done that well enough. We don't have to keep doing this anymore. We can't get into Yellowstone. You can't get into Yosemite. I mean, there are very few places like this left on earth. And there are some places, like try to go to Japan and find some space. You know, they've got a little garden in the backyard where they've got all kinds of stuff growing in a little tiny square footage. Or it's inside the house, where the house is built around this garden, and those kinds of things. And if you look at studies from anthropology, for instance, what happens to monkeys and chimpanzees when these crowded conditions and their sexual behavior gets aberrant? And think of the inner city while I'm mentioning these things. There's a lot more violence because they don't have the room to move away from each other and go, wow, I'm glad I got out of that situation. They can't get away. They're right there, face to face. There's no place to back up. There's a wall behind them, and their friends go and go for it because there's so many people, they have nowhere to move. And so the violence comes. So, and another aspect of this is that there's no wilderness nature to be in. Those kids in the inner city are in brick and cement and noise. And they turn to rock and roll because it's noisier than the internal noise, I think. I mean, there's a lot about this. I can go on for hours on this stuff. My wife studies some of the effects of music and rock and roll and things. And it's bad for you to hear these sounds. And it makes you nervous and upset and want to, you know, be energetic. And there's something about it, too, that's an expression of anger. So it comes out of this culture. But not having nature, not having nature to learn from, and we have ignored nature in our culture. We have said, no, we don't have to do that. We're an exception. We have wiped out all of our competitors for food, all the other species. We basically have wiped them out. We've had greater war on them than we've had on each other. And we've justified it, thinking that we're the end of the evolutionary scale. It's all here for us. I mean, all of this arrogance, self-centeredness, and grandiosity has to be looked at along with all of this. It's underlying every bit of this, where we have a responsibility to realize that God made all living things, all living people, and Jesus made no exceptions to that. You know, he didn't say that we got to take care of the earth like a number of religions have. I don't see that, but he certainly did say that we're to love everybody, and we're all God's children.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Jack, did you
finally just can make two quick responses? One to the I think you're absolutely right in terms of the School of the Americas is really a symbolic struggle. If the school is closed, it doesn't mean it ends the policy or the end of it. But it is such a powerful symbol that it becomes a tool at which we can raise broader questions, it seems to me. So I think it's a very important, real as well as symbolic struggle, but there's structures behind it, as you said, that are really important. And in terms of the population thing, just to say there were two meetings very recently the big UN population conference in Cairo, and then the women's conference in Beijing. And both of those, I think, had a very, for the most part, a very healthy approach to the issue of population. And from what I can gather is each of them drew on the experience of Kerala, India. And Kerala, India is one of the most populous states. It's a state in India. But it's a very interesting place because it's a place that's very poor. It has a per capita income of less than $200 a year. And yet it has dramatically reduced its birth rate, offers free education to all, has 90% literacy rate, because it has focused on issues of food, land, healthcare, literacy, etc. And the take on both the conference in Beijing and the conference in Cairo was that population is very, very important, but the way to reduce it is not simply family planning, but it's addressing these broader issues, especially the development of women. Now, here's the interesting connection, I think, to this discussion, too, is that a friend of mine who was at the conference in Cairo, I think the figure that he gave me was, the estimate was that we could, that if women had access to family planning, if we were to follow a program of empowering women through literacy, etc., that it would cost about $25 billion a year to get that spread out in grassroots ways around the world. And they estimated that through that, 4 billion unwanted pregnancies would be stopped in the next 30 years. 4 billion unwanted pregnancies. Well, that's a lot of unwanted pregnancies, and it's a lot of, I think, social problems that wouldn't happen, and a lot of social problems that would be resolved if you focused on women in development, literacy, education, those things. $25 billion a year, again, is less than the annual budget of the Central Intelligence Agency, or a couple of bombers. So I would just, again, agree with you in the context of peace and peacemaking and security, we've got our heads screwed on absolutely backwards, it seems to me.
Are there other people who want to share comments or ask questions or tell stories about ways that you practice peace in your lives? Sure.
Well, just two things. One, the school I teach in is a very active peer mediation and peacemaking program. And so I see that work locally, but what I'm concerned with is just more on a macro level, that the messages that people are given in across the society, that mainline churches and more progressive-leaning peoples haven't gotten involved in politics as much as some of the other end. And I don't know how we can encourage that. I mean, my father's a pastor, and he's great at preaching the gospel, but he's only in the last few years has from the pulpit taken a more, applied that some to what has happened in the political realm, as opposed to just preaching the good news that God saved us, meeting forgiveness, that type of thing. And so I don't know how we get people to realize that some of these issues aren't going to be solved unless we get involved in the political end of things. I don't know how that happens, because as Lutherans and as Protestants or Christians, the Christian right, which thinks has a certain other views of things, I think has really monopolized that end of things. So I don't know, Peter or Jack, do you or Karen have some ideas on how that could happen, how to get people more energized politically?
Well, I think for one thing, it means helping people to see that part of how God is active is through institutions of society, including government and political processes. Now, that doesn't mean we have the Christian answer, and I think there's reasons why we've really shied away from, you know, the kind of, you know, this is a Christian answer. I mean, in addition to some of the separation of church and state kinds of issues that would involve. But I think, you know, seeing you mentioned Lutheran, I think for us as Lutherans, I'm going to be doing a session on this tomorrow, a matter of being very clear that we stand within a tradition that has had a lot of strong respect for the role of government, sometimes in a way that some of us have maybe cringed at because it's, you know, well, government right or wrong, you know, I'm going to support it. But I think calling us as, you know, the calling of citizenship is an outgrowth of our baptismal calling. And therefore, the being involved in those processes is, from that perspective, not an optional kind of thing or, say, a matter of saying, well, we need to stay away from those issues because all we're concerned about is, quote, some spiritual arena off here. But it's all intertwined.
Other responses to this gentleman before we move over here?
Well, it seemed to me, and I'm not a theologian, but it's just in looking at society that the churches more often than not have been part of the problem rather than part of the solution. That they're large institutions and they are designed to make people keep coming to church and keep making contributions and feel good about what they're doing. So, I mean, I think most traditional churches do exactly what you're talking about. That is, they don't get involved and they like to make people think that as long as they come to church on Sunday morning, that that's all they have to do. And if they are making a lot of money, that God has blessed them, and you know, they don't really have responsibility other than to, you know, raise their kids with a decent family. So I think churches, the institutional churches, I think are, and the Pope, I think, a lot of his policies, I think, are not at all progressive. I think where I see people from churches that are willing to do things that I think need to be done in society for human rights or addressing wrongs, I think it's a real minority. Like Father Bourgeois, he started doing this, and when he started doing it, I mean, it was a real challenge in his order. They just about threw him out. And only persistent work over the years has he been able to get an authorization from the Marinoles to continue to do this work. And they are very, very progressive order, unlike many others. And so, and the Catholic Church has a very radical wing, and I have gotten to meet many of them. Many of them are former priests that have gone into peace work and really made it their life's work. And I really don't see even a community like that coming out of the Protestant churches.
Well, I have two very quick responses. One is, I think we have a theological crisis in our churches. And I think part of the solution is that we need to take the life of Jesus much, much more seriously than we do. If we were to do that, it would lead us organically or naturally into a kind of politics that would reflect a lot of the values. So I think that really we need to encourage in our congregations much greater freedom just to really explore just how radical Jesus was and what that might mean for us. And then secondly, I mentioned this the other night, but I kind of made a decision politically that one of the ways I think that we can get people involved in a different kind of politics is because children and families are in such deep crisis in this society. And I think it's a really powerful lens to view the world and to deal with people's real deep anxieties. And the Republicans aren't going to save us. The Democrats aren't going to save us. Colin Powell isn't going to save us. None of the third party candidates are going to save us. It's going to take us a while to learn that, but I really do believe that it's a lens that's going to force us to rethink a lot of things, which is, again, why I wrote this book, Families Value, because I believe that. Now, we'll see if that actually happens, but I think the potential is really there. Now, there's something very, very practical that people are being eaten up about. Is a real way to talk about, well, what do we need to be doing politically if we really care about something like children and family.
And that's a key to, I mean, to get even more practical, my experience, limited as it is in community organizing, says that that's the place where you organize people is around what their gut interest is. And people are worried about their families and about their kids, especially in the cities. Mm. So, There was a gentleman back here. Please.
Well, I guess before this was kind of answered, I was thinking one other time when you were here, Jack, you turned us on to the Christic Institute, and we supported them. And when the Bush administration put them out of business by suing them, it really did something to me. And I was thinking about the perseverance that we need. And that's a hard commodity, because when you get overloaded with all the information, all the gunky stuff that's going on in the world, you just kind of get to the point where you just want to say, oh, I've had it, you know. And that perseverance has to be rejuvenated every so often. And there aren't enough leaders around to most places that have that energy that they can put into that. And I just, I would like to be, you know, more energized along this. But then you come along all these decisions to make, you know, where you want to make a strong statement, and you might not have the background to back it up. You know, it's frustrating.
Well, my quick comment to that comment is, you know, Ricky and Peter and I were, I'm sure we feel much of the same gunk as you do with all stuff going on. But one of the things we have is each other in an organized community. And I would just really encourage, I don't know what your lives are like, or what your neighborhoods are like, or what your churches are like, but I would say in my experience, and I think in our experience, what we really find is if you're going to have persistence, then you need to be strongly rooted with a group of others who are committed to helping you maintain your sense of humor and helping you think creatively about how to live. And without that, you know, as flawed as our community is, I would feel very, very much alone. And I don't feel alone. I don't ever feel alone. I always feel like I have this group of people with whom I'm connected, and we're struggling together to figure out as best we can.
I think I feel alone.
Yeah.
Please, I'll come to you, John, but first let's to Ricky.
Yeah, I was just kind of thinking when you said all the gunk and stuff, like, you know, our community is real active in lots of peace and justice stuff, and we do really feel that support from one another. But, you know, I think sometimes one thing that's even lacking in that community is that everybody's trying to do a different project, and they're all wonderful, but everybody kind of gets just worn out. And I would think that it would help, and I'm kind of thinking about your question, David, you know, to have a focus where you have, you know, just one centering project or one centering theme, because usually one project branches out and affects everything. It's not like it's, you know, it's not just one little piece. And I just think that would help. I know we saw this really violent movie on, what was it, Last of the Mohicans on the airplane. And my kid was there, and I was covering his eyes, and I was furious. And I wrote him a letter, and I said I was going to be determined that this was going to stop, that they weren't going to do this. And so I got petitions from everybody in our community and sent him another letter. And finally, I kind of just lost my resolve, because I was lost it. And it was probably because the airlines felt so powerful to me, and partly, you know, I was the only one doing that project. And I don't mean that the whole community should have suddenly dropped all their stuff and helped me, but I think it would help if everybody, you know, just kind of found something together that they cared about and kind of could be a rallying point. And like if the congregation is more conservative, maybe, you know, to start with something that's a little stretch that might, you know, get bigger. I don't know. That's just what I'm...
That's a good example too, because that, I mean, the concern that you raised was one that cuts across all political categories. I don't know any group of people that isn't concerned about TV images and violence, for example.
Well, I was just thinking one place where I lost my resolve. I'm not saying that should be the issue, but...
John?
Well, Jesus sent out the disciples, and I was wondering, I'm so impressed with St. Martin's Table. I feel like he's in Minneapolis, but the other hand, it would be wonderful if, and I wonder if you do this, do you consult with other people, to, or would you, if people wanted to get something like your community going, or could you write a book about it?
You know how it got going?
I think John Schramm, the mayor.
Yeah, right out of here. I mean, this is the whole seed of everything, is that when they were ready to go out into the world away from Holden, they wanted to, you know, bring some of this spirit into an urban setting so that, you know, it would work in people's day-to-day lives.
But I think the answer to your question is, one, we would probably be a little bit cautious just because we sound better than we are. But two, I think within the restraint of just life, that you'd probably find, you know, some willingness to certainly be in conversation, and, you know, there might be possibility of a range of visits or something. Yeah, and really, I think what we need to say too is that what we have done, which I'll maybe talk a little bit about tomorrow if people are interested in my last session, you know, on one level, it's not a model that anybody needs to do exactly what we're doing, but I think the fact that we are doing something is a hopeful sign to a lot of people, and just in sharing with you what we do, it might give you some ideas about what you could do, because it doesn't have to look the same, but it just takes a few committed people who really want to link their lives together in meaningful ways to make something happen, I think, what you'd say.
We have a couple of minutes left, and I'd like to make a proposal for closing this peace statement that the Lutheran Church passed last year. In its introduction says, as our world discards the mindset of the Cold War and faces new threats and opportunities of a changing time, we join with others in searching for what makes for peace. And that's a quote, not in quotes, but from Jesus in Luke 19, where he comes into Jerusalem and says, if you only knew the things that make for peace. So just reflect for a minute and then share with the group things that you do in your lives that you think make for peace. They can be personal things, they can be communal things, they can be national and international political actions that you do. And just share those with the group so that as we go out from this place, we have some of the wisdom that each of us lives with in struggling with this question and trying to act those things out in our lives.
We visit prisoners, and the reoccurring thing we hear is that they've never felt loved. And when they get out of prison, will they have learned new ways to be violent within prison, or will they get something from a feeling of being loved?
Thank you.
Well, it's
sure.
Well, perhaps it's a nerdy, rarefied, unreal atmosphere via the internet. There are many different discussions that one can engage in, where you're talking with someone from Japan, from Germany, from Russia on particular issues.
Yeah.
So even if you're just dealing with a particular issue, a small group of people for a limited period of time, you've at least covered some ground, kept the question flowing.
Sure. Janie, you had your hand up.
I guess for me, it's become something more than I ever thought, but it started when I was able to live 2 years in Bolivia and in a small Christian-based community and start to develop relationships. And it took a lot of courage as a 21-year-old, you know, I'm sure many people here have had journeys like that, but to continue to engage in that kind of journey and to continue to enter into relationships that cross boundaries in your life, you know, and it's not always easy, but that's where I think the peace then emerges in the relationships.
Mm-hmm. Something I want to share that I've been working in inner cities for I don't know, 8 years now, off and on. And one of the things I'm learning slowly from African-American brothers and sisters is to pay attention to where my money goes and who it supports. Mm-hmm. One of the things I've learned from especially inner city groups of African-Americans is that to build up a neighborhood, they start paying really close attention to where their money is and what banks take their money and what kind of loans those banks give back to their community, what stores they shop at and all that kind of stuff. So I'm thinking that with the money that I do have, I can make a difference by thinking about where it goes and what kind of multiplying effects my spending of money can have. So that's something I'm exploring. Did I see a hand up on the balcony? No. Just people kind of coming forward. Okay, back here.
Some pretty basic things, I guess. We concentrate very hard on making sure that we listen carefully to all sides of the issues so that we can make our decisions based upon not, you know, a spot here or a spot there, but on the whole issue. We concentrate very hard on making sure that our family is a strong, united family, and that my grown children have the values that will continue to develop strong families. We try to stay active in our community with both the rich and the poor, because I find that in my community, the rich support a ton that I can't do, and the poor still need some help. And we stay very, very active in our congregation, because the church is still the heart of where the family comes from.
Thank you. Other ideas or peace practices that people live out in their lives? Sure, back here.
Support and work with Habitat for Humanity.
That's a good one. Raises the question of economic justice and of people having decent housing. Yeah. Well, I hope the conversation continues and that this has sparked some new ideas and thoughts, and that you'll follow up with people you found interesting during this discussion. And I thank all of you for coming, certainly, and I thank our panelists for being willing to get us going tonight. So, thanks.
One thing, though, that in the old tradition of Holden, they used to have to go until 2 or 3 in the morning.
I have to have an official closing, and then if you want to stay until 2 or 3 in the morning.
People starving out, including the director.